Welcome to Catching Up with Comedians. I'm your host, Rich Stein.
Well, hi.
Is this Kat Simmons?
This is she.
Wow, all the way from somewhere up in old Nevada.
Nevada. You got to get the Nevada straight.
Oh, that's how you locals do it.
Yeah, that's how all of us in this state do it. Yep, Nevada. I am sitting here in my living room looking at the snow-capped Eastern Sierra Mountains, counting my blessings.
Wow. I think we got that among other things in common. I've stayed away from Los Angeles. I've been an Orange County guy for most of I've been out here 50 years now. I landed here when I was 18. Now I'm 68. 68
well,
pushing 70. Are you a 55 or a 56 model?
56. I just had the big 6'8 in February. What about you? When's your birthday?
I'll be 69 May 16th.
Oh, you're much older than I am.
Oh my God, yeah.
Go
ahead.
Your birthday is 2 days after my boyfriend. He'll be 70, so he's much older than I am.
Oh my God, what a geezer.
Yeah.
I'm just going to start saying I'm 70 because you know, the joke, George Carlin, who was one of my mentors. Now, notwithstanding his, you know, myriad drug use and his various, you know, things he did, he was certainly, you can't argue with the fact that he was one prolific comedian.
Oh my God, it was unending. I had a rare experience to work with him at Bally's in Vegas. I have the sheet of yellow pad paper in some of my memorabilia.
Sure.
He just came in and added his name to the set list in the green room to work out when he was doing his anorexic bit and the golfing bit.
I don't want to eat.
It was interesting because he walked the room. I mean, people were not amused.
Oh, no.
You know, such a fine line, right, between making a philosophical point and being angry and being funny. And he hadn't quite crossed the line into the complete funny part on that bit. But as we know, it became quite famous and he did just fine.
Exactly. But
even George had those nights, you know?
Sure, of course.
I've
remember when I used to put up a lot of my old clippings and then I just started writing. My wife said, you should just write obituaries for comedians.
You're the guy. Yeah.
But then I found out there's no money in it.
No money in it. Just a lot of hard work and record keeping. But you're the guy. You're the one that you and who else does some cool stuff like that? Eddie Brill. And Richie Scheidner, they have some great,
Richie,
a lot of memories.
Richie's become kind of a, you know, since the latter days of, you know, since Facebook and stuff, I've gotten to know him pretty well. I've gone to two of his, have you ever seen any incarnation of his Comedy History show?
No, I would love to. I've actually talked to him a couple times through Facebook. I mean, I knew him when I lived in LA, but I used to produce shows up here. So anytime anybody had any thought of being able to do a show somewhere, they would, you know, obviously contact me. And I sure wish I had a venue for him because I would have loved to have gone to. And so you saw it?
I saw him at the Comedy and Magic about a month before COVID. It was Christmas, so there was stockings and candy canes over the parking meters, which, you know, as a comedian is like, oh, I don't have to pay $39 to park and still get a ticket and get towed away in Hermosa Beach.
Santa.
You know? So Kevin Rooney was there, and I took my father-in-law and my best friend, and he was kind of still, you know, I mean, that was 2020, so he was kind of just. He had been doing it for a while, and then I went and saw him at the Yard, which is kind of like a eclectic little kind of tree hugger hippie little 100-seater equity theater off of Melrose, I think. And that was probably close to 2 years ago now. But so I've seen it twice, and I know he's just I posted on his thing the other day because now he's doing it. Because I'm from the East Coast originally. I'm from Fairfield, Connecticut, and he's from, you know, New Jersey. But everybody, he got out of California, like a lot of people do, because he goes, up, East Coast was calling. That's what he said. You know, his parents are still alive in their 90s. I mean, so that's
wow. Isn't he in, like, North Carolina?
Yeah, he's in Asheville.
Yeah.
Which they have a yearly comedy festival there. And my wife, my daughter, and I, we went through there. They have, like, it's kind of like the Austin, if you would, of North Carolina, because they have kind of an eclectic little artsy community there.
Very progressive,
Asheville. I mean, that's where Harry Anderson ended up after he kind of got tired of living down in New Orleans. Harry Anderson, he kind of ended up there and even was doing a magic show there. And sadly, he kind of died young in context.
Yeah, he sure did.
I don't know. I don't think he was 70 yet, you know. Anytime somebody now dies and they haven't hit 80, even when you die and you're 82, you're still, they could have made 90, you know.
Yeah, could have been a George Burns, but didn't make it,
So I have been looking over your, I read that you were born, right? It seems like you're from the San Jose. Did you grow up your whole... like childhood life there?
No, I was born in Palo Alto lived, at the Stanford Memorial Hospital.
Wow.
And
fancy.
I know. It's like being even born close to Stanford. Mm-hmm. I would hope it would have enhanced my IQ, but I'm not sure it helped at all. But so I lived down, in Roma City for a heartbeat and then Mountain View, San Jose is the only one I can remember is lived in San Jose.
Because I was taking it off your Facebook, because I always kind of assumed you might have just been from up in the Tahoe area where you spent most of your, seems like, adult life. You know?
Yeah. Well, moved to Reno.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny. My dad pulled us out of San Jose and took us back to his homeland in Reno because he was just afraid that San Jose was just, going to hell in a handbasket. Mm-hmm. So he takes us to Reno where there's 24-hour-a-day gambling.
Where it's already hell.
Prostitution. Come on, we're going back to my roots, kids. But it was cool. We lived out in the country and we had 3.5 acres and a pond, which was... Oh my God! Mm-hmm. Having a pond as a kid—I mean, that was had a lot of friends when you have a pond and a barn and horses. I was a horse woman. I kind of grew up on a horse, so that was the big draw of
you can't really beat that. I'm an old tree hugger at heart. You know, I've got to be around.
Yeah.
I've got to be around trees and ocean doesn't hurt. But yeah, I always said like you go down to LA and it's just, I told all, like my friend does a kind of a workout showcase night at Cantor's. They've been doing it there for 10 years. But, you know, here's a place that's worth $50 million. You know, they're still pushing out pastrami and corned beef like it's going out of style. But they can't power wash their sidewalk, you know, on Fairfax. I go, couldn't you bust out with a power wash here? Like, I mean, it's like, it is just, it's like, it's just ridiculous. I mean, that's why people take their shoes off. Because if you ever walk down the sidewalk in front of Cantor's, there's like.
Yeah, don't wear those. When I first moved to LA, I remember having, because I live in this beautiful valley. The Carson Valley is just amazing. It's high desert. There's pasture. Ooh. There's cattle. There's Lake Tahoe. I can be at the beach at Lake Tahoe in 25 minutes, be in Reno in 50.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, tons and tons of open space and green. And I remember having some, anxiety attacks almost when I got to LA. Like I'd start looking around, I go, there's no dirt. Like there's no dirt.
I know.
Like everything has concrete or asphalt or rebar on it. And so thank God for the beach. So I used to go to Zuma Beach a lot, and Malibu Beach, just to feel like I.
So how old were you when you first moved? You had already made, because I want to get into a little bit of the Sal Mar stuff, but how? Had you already kind of, you were going down there kind of like a lot of people do with stars in your eyes. You go, well, I'm going to go try stand up and that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, I was, I had really just turned 30 when I did a stand up comedy contest up at Lake Tahoe and it was like for money. I was so naive. Richie. I had no idea these people had their jokes on 3x5 cards, right. And I was like, I'm in way over my head. But yeah. I was 29 when I did that contest, and I had already planned to go to LA to be an actor because I'd done theater for like 6 years. So my original thing was like, I just wanted to have a sitcom. I wanted to be an actor. Sure. And so, but then I got dared to do this contest and I did it. And oh my God, I just, my only goal was to just not physically die on the stage. And it actually went pretty well. And some people in the audience said, how long have you been doing stand-up? I said, about 10 minutes.
First time. And that just kills anybody who's been doing it for 2 years or more. They just want to go jump off the stage.
But they gave me a bunch of numbers. So I moved to LA. I was in LA a month later. And so I turned 30 when I was in LA. So tender age of 30. And here I leave the, I got hayseeds in my hair and no idea how to pronounce any of these. I remember the first time I had to say Cahuenga Boulevard. I was like, how the hell do you say this? But yeah, I just leapt. I just got down there and I hadn't planned on doing stand up, but I fell so in love with it on the first night that I was like in LA at the Comedy Store literally two nights later. And
do you remember running it? Because I'm sure Argus was already.
Argus was there. And Sam Kinison. Check it out. Sam Kinison and Carl LeBeau and. Andrew Dice Clay, all those guys. That was 1987.
But you hadn't heard of any of those guys.
No, I didn't know any of these. I mean, I knew about Steve Martin and Bob Newhart and Carol Burnett and Lucille Ball. That was it.
Yeah.
And so I go to the Comedy Store, literally like the second night, I just go there and I go as a student and I sit in the front row in the main room with a notebook.
Wow.
With a notebook to take notes on all these comics. I'm surprised I didn't get kicked out stealing material, which I wasn't.
No.
I was just describing. I mean, I wish I could find that notebook now describing Sam Kinison. There's a man with long hair screaming and his face is all red and I'm frightened. But I'm also laughing, you know? So yeah, I got there right when things were just popping.
Right.
And
87, So you were, so technically you started a little on the late side. If you were just starting at 30, I did my first stand up at 27 and I always consider that was late. You know, I mean, when you figure kids now come out of the womb and they get an IMDb credit, thanks. We're going to give you a thanks for being born. You got your first IMDb credit.
So in
Argus's defense, he had already probably done a bunch of Tonight shows, but you weren't a devotee really of.
No, I was of Johnny Carson. I used to record Johnny Carson on cassette tapes and listen back to those cassette tapes.
That's cool. So it was in your blood then, the comedy gene was in your blood.
It was in my blood. And like when I did the theater, I'd always end up with the funny parts. Even if they weren't funny, they kind of ended up being funny. But I never thought about being a comic ever until I did that contest. And then I was like, wait a minute. This is, that was the most terrifying thing I've ever done and the funnest thing I've ever done. And, you know, with the vote of approval from those people in the audience who are still my dear friends, sadly, one of them has passed away, but Lynn and Morris Walker, they just wrote me a whole bunch of numbers. Call Tony Attell, get into cold reading workshops. So I just went down there and I just leapt. I went in, I was doing cold reading workshops and improv and got an acting coach and doing every open mic night I could do and. You know, 3 day jobs, the usual thing, best times of my life.
So you were doing a full immersion. You were doing a full immersion. And you probably tracked a lot faster than a person coming up and going, well, I'll go to the Natural Fudge tonight and then we'll go get
stoned. Oh, I used to go there.
I love that.
I met a guy named Najayo Belam.
Oh, I know that name. I think
he
did comedy.
Name?
Oh, yeah.
He did. He had like dreadlocks.
Yeah, sure.
I think he might have been the cousin of Jimmy Walker. Could that be possible? I don't know. But
I've seen
remember
that name for
him.
Years, yeah.
From the natural fudge.
Right, right.
That's funny. That's still there, huh?
Well, no, it's not in that incarnation. Oh. The building might be there. But I remember, because, you know, I keep all those old, I put a flyer out from the 1987 that had the Ed Wynn Theater. And I just love looking at the address.
The big drum.
Wow.
The big drum stage.
Wow.
Right downtown.
Yeah.
Was that on Figueroa?
I think so. I have the sheet. Because when I taught, I used to take all these old yellowed, I love a real old yellowed newspaper clipping, but I could take it, and there was one component called remove background, and it would take all the yellow, and it would take all that dingy, dark white, and so
funny.
Now you could see it brought it back to life, but I always post like the old version and then the newer version, so.
Well, we must have probably been on that stage at the same time together, signing up on the yellow legal pad taped in the back, you know,
taped on the wall. Or I know now these young comics, I've been crawling back up on stage since I retired from teaching, and it's not uncommon for some of these rooms to have like 50 comics signing their name on it. It's like, that's when saying, it's like, I know if there is such a thing as too many, I always say there's not too many comedians now, there are too many people purporting to be comedians, you know. It's like,
well, it's so commercial now. I mean, with the advent of every, you know, Netflix and streaming and YouTube, and I mean, it's a lot easier to be seen.
Right.
And I think a lot of people think, well, if they can do that, I can do that. And maybe back in our day, gotta sound old, but it was a little harder to be, you know, it wasn't as consumable. Maybe you had to buy a ticket and go to a theater.
Right. You ever read any of the Cliff Nesteroff stuff or listen to his?
No.
Oh my God.
No.
You know who he is though, right?
I've heard of it.
You know, he's got a big audience, but he talks about how in the older days of the Marx Brothers, you know, the vaudeville circuit, these people were considered like the pariahs of the human race. So when they came into town, it's like, farmers, hire your daughters, you know. And they were like, they were smoking the reefer. They were all on booze, and they wanted to, you know, have illicit sex. And so, but he said in the Marx Brothers days, it wasn't uncommon. You'd get, you know, you'd be sleeping in these horrible places where they put you up, and there'd be rats and all kinds of stuff like that. And the living conditions were intolerable. So, I just heard a click.
Still there? I just tapped my ear.
Oh, okay. That's
so
it.
I will make sure not
good,
to
though.
Do
yeah,
that. Okay, Jess.
I know I love it when old time, when they have people on like talk shows and they have a lavalier mic on and they keep rubbing the lavalier.
Or the collar. The collar. There's a necklace. Have you seen performer with the necklace on? I'm like, or they're popping their peas. I'm such a sound Nazi.
That's what they said Cyndi Lauper was driving, not Barry Gordon, what's his name? The guy who was the major producer of that We Are the World. I don't know if you saw that thing, but he said that Cyndi Lauper, when she did her part of We Are the World, she was driving everybody crazy because she had all her necklaces and chains around her neck, and they couldn't, what in the hell is that dinging and ringing? And they finally said, take off your 50 necklaces.
I just wanted to say
that the whole Cliff Nesteroff, he takes all the evolution, and then the Buddy Hackett and all those guys, they had to come up to where they didn't have, you know, they were past the vaudeville circuit, but they still had to play Playboy clubs, and they basically played strip bars, and they played joints and dives, and Lenny Bruce used to call it a toilet, because the first time you walk in the club, the first thing you smell is the toilet, you know, and he was jazzed.
So
our generation, we actually had comedy clubs, so they always looked at us as spoiled, and now people are doing comedy in their, there's people out here that I've seen that aren't the greatest comedians, they just book comedy in their garage or in their living room.
Yeah,
you know, like, that's the good way to beat the system. Come over. Where's the club? Well, it's my house.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people were doing that during COVID too.
That's
you know,
true,
house
too.
Parties and garage comedy
all that
and
kind of stuff.
I mean, you get and this is what I saw when I was booking rooms is that you know, a lot of bookers or producers, they're just looking for people who can put butts in seats. And if you've got, you know, millions of followers on Twitter and Instagram, and you've got a YouTube channel, they look at all that before they'll even look at the quality of your copy. And I won't name this person, but one of the best demo tapes I ever got was from a guy out of Boston, and it was three Tonight Show sets, 6 minutes. Technically perfect, clean, tight sets.
Yeah.
I put him up on stage in my little room here in, you know, Carson Valley, Nevada to do 45 minutes. No way. No way could he catch that audience. He couldn't connect with them. There was no beginning, middle, and end of the show. But so that's the thing. You know, you send a clean Tonight Show set to a producer, they're like, ah, oh, they're all that. Not necessarily true.
That's true. You know? I know you can't. It takes a different animal to do 45 live.
And, yeah.
And that's why I went out on the road. I did the Comedy Store the first time I ever did comedy, June 14th, 1982. But it just wasn't, I could immediately see that this isn't a place I'm going to be coming to a lot because I just didn't like the vibe there. You know, it's like.
Yeah, there was a darkness there for sure.
And I didn't need to be, well, you know, I'm just repeating kind of like what Jerry Seinfeld said. And I've got a lot of, like, Argus is a friend, I actually, you know, I talk to him quite often. But Jerry Seinfeld always said it was kind of a lot of broken, Mitzi was taking in broken, you know, people that were kind of broken. I mean, Sam Kinison and all these people, they were kind of, you know, it was a different vibe there, you know, there was a lot of drugs and all that kind of stuff. And
yeah, it was like a Codependence Anonymous support group. I mean, not to say that there's much talent that came out of there. It was just it's just historic, but there was a lot of dysfunction and
oh my god.
And I was sensitive to that. It didn't keep, you know, but I also went on the
road. Were never into all that kind of scene, I don't imagine.
Yeah, no, I started comedy clean and sober. So I've never been on stage a day in my life under the influence of anything other than adrenaline and maybe some caffeine. But
Did you listen to any of that Tommy Moore thing I did? It was the first two podcasts. He's a guy who's like in his 70s and I wanted to have him on. I mean, he's so great that I called some people and they said, well, I don't want to do it after listening to him because he's like so good. You know, he's so.
That is why I didn't listen to anything on purpose before better, I did this. But I will listen after because I just hate to, you know, compare and
I hear you.
I'll listen now.
he's such a fun guy. He talks at length about how Pat Cooper came to his comedy. He was a Philly guy. He was smart. He goes, the first time I saw a comic on Ed Sullivan and I heard they made $5,000 for 5 minutes and no heavy lifting. He goes, that's what I knew. But he's got a great voice and he's got the stories. Yeah. He knew off the top of his head, he knew everything because he hung out with Shecky Green a million times. Shecky Green gave him his start. He said, hey, he went to the Westbury Music Fair when he was just still in college and Shecky said to the booker, I want you to let this kid here in every night. I'll be here 7 nights. And when he wants to come to my green room, he goes, he was the nicest guy in the world. And Pat Cooper, he said he would come and talk to his students that he had because he taught at Temple University for 5 years.
Yeah.
And even after I'm doing it, I try not to interrupt people. I do. I've been having some trouble with my voice lately, and I said it's probably because I've been talking nonstop for 68 years. That might have something to do with, you know, though.
Yeah, you might have a polyp. You better check it.
No, I don't. I actually, I've had a camera down my throat. No polyps, none of that stuff.
You're just getting that raspy, gravelly, got some wisdom voice. Yeah,
of course. I mean, look at Bob Einstein, the funniest guy that ever lived, and you can hardly even kind of. He had the real scratchy voice, you know, super dude I was born.
Yeah.
So he, anyway, that was what I forget where we were going before. You can listen to either one of them, but he did so much that I turned it into two. Instead of part two, I just said, we talked about Shecky Green, but he talked about Rickles and all these other guys in the context. So, excuse me, I need to get a cough button on my editor here. So tell me, I did go back and do it because we, what years? I do kind of want to know though, like you, I'm going to say you, I don't think you were down in this area for that many years. How many years was
only
it?
Only six.
Okay.
87 to 92.
Yeah, that was probably mm-hmm. just enough, you know.
That was just enough.
Get the hell out of here. 86, yeah, that was perfect because you caught the end of the comedy boom. You really caught the premium end because by 92, people were starting to go, check, please, you know.
Uh-huh.
All the clubs, they papered the death out of the club. Because I came back from my motorhome trip in 93, and that's when my friend said, hey, they're hiring substitute teachers. I'd been in a motorhome for 9 months, you know, so I was,
wow.
You know, I was a little ripe.
And, right.
Yeah, so it was.
Having a shower and a day job didn't sound horrible then, huh?
Yeah. So 86 to 92, and in that time, did you end up doing some acting jobs just for the experience of it, or did you pretty much say, no, I'm just going to stay committed to stand up?
I you know, I had an agent. Mm-hmm. I went out on auditions, but then what I was faced with is, you know, I was doing everything. I was doing too many things. Mm-hmm. I had eggs in every basket, and then I just finally made a decision to, like, I was with an improv group, and I accidentally auditioned for the Groundlings. This is a great story.
Okay.
When I first moved down there, I talked to this lady who was a friend of my friend that saw me at that show up at the lake when I did the contest, and she said, call Tony Attell. She does these she does these cold reading workshops. So I called her. She gave me the lowdown. I went not knowing anything about what this meant.
Right.
I walked in to this theater door. They said second door on the left on Cahuenga Boulevard, which I couldn't even say. Cahuenga. I had to have no idea what to say. Mm-hmm. So I'm in this thing. This workshop, they got me on stage being a piece of bacon in a frying pan, being fruit in a blender, doing a trust walk. I thought, what the hell am I, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
And it's halftime, and then the guy wants to collect the checks, and he says, I got to write a check for $350. And I went over to him and kind of whispered in his ear. I said, well, I talked to Tony Attell last night, and she told me it was going to be $25. Like, maybe I knew somebody. He goes, well, then you better go next door over to Tony Attell's class. I was in the wrong room, but I auditioned for the Groundlings, and I made it based on an accident.
Wow.
So I excuse myself. I go next door. I've missed almost all of Tony's class. Jeff Greenberg, the casting director from Cheers, is there.
Wow.
So I still get to read. He hands me a side. He goes, could you read this, please, with a Russian accent? Now, I'm in L.A. from 2 days from the alfalfa fields, right? I'm like, oh, yeah, sure, no problem. Yeah. I go in the bathroom. I'm deep breathing. And the only thing I can do is think of Yakov Smirnoff's ad campaign. You know, the only way to vote in Russia is to defect. And I'm just saying it over and over in my head. And I came out to just try to gently slip back into that that room. And I tripped on the concrete step. And crashed into a metal mop bucket with mops and brooms going everywhere. The whole class is looking at me. Jeff Greenberg's glasses go down to the end of his nose. I'm like, yep, I have arrived in Hollywood. Anyway, but to answer your question, I was doing a little bit of everything. And then I finally just decided, you know, I had an acting coach that I loved, and I was going out on some commercial auditions. I did a little independent film, and, you know, but then I was spreading myself so thin. I just thought, I'm going to just focus on doing stand up. So I didn't, if I was going to do stand up, I couldn't just do it in LA. I had to go on the road. And that's what I just kept hearing from everybody. Yeah. You got to go on the road. Mm-hmm. Well, going on the road made it really hard to be there for audition season. Right. So I quit my day job, and I didn't have any money saved, didn't have the car paid off. None of the stuff I planned on doing. But do you remember that club, Pierre Turgeon's club down in Oceanside called Comedy Night.
Comedy Night. Pierre Turgeon, who did a stint in the Slammer. I'm glad.
Yep, he did. That's a whole different story. I could tell you about that. But he used to book the hot springs. It was like a what was it called? In Temecula. Oh, it was like a little spa retreat, and he had a one-nighter, and I that was my very first gig, and I worked it with Billy Reback.
Oh, wow.
And some other really funny guy. I can't remember, but I got a $50 bill, and I remember thinking, oh, my God, $50 and a free dinner for just talking?
Mm-hmm. Especially a U.S. grant, an actual $50 bill. You know, absolutely. One of my favorite bills. You know.
Oh, my God, I'll never forget it. And I wrote that man a thank you card because I'm a good small town girl. Sure, thank you for hiring me, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. So fast forward a year and a half later, he opens his own club. Mm-hmm. He asks a comedy friend of mine, he goes, is that Cat Sevens girl still around? Mm-hmm. Yep, she lives in Glendale. And she gave him my phone number. He called me to open that club for him.
Oh, cool.
And I had just quit my day job, had nothing on the books, nothing, not one date. I cried all the way home from quitting that timeshare sales job.
Yeah, God.
And then I got that job like the next day, started that the next week, worked with a guy named Neil Edwards, who I quickly befriended. And took
Comedy Night was that was a multi-night gig, wasn't it? Like three or four.
Oh, yeah,
nights.
It was like five nights. Yeah. Five nights. Yeah.
So I went worked from with nothing. Gabe Kaplan there one time.
Oh, you did? Yeah. It's a great club. It was, there was some seedy stuff going on there for sure. Yeah. But my point is that I quit the day job with complete faith that somehow I was going to be taken care of. And I went from no work to 6 weeks worth of work in a week.
See, that's kind of how it goes when you do take a leap of faith. I mean, more times than not, it really does go that way.
Yeah, it was. There was no mistake there, you know. So then I was off and running on the road for 6 years.
Wow! Did you do some, you know, East Coast stuff?
You know, it's weird. I never worked really the East Coast. Yeah. I did everywhere, but I did a lot of. I worked in Texas. It seemed like months every year. Yeah. But you know, the South,
Spellbinders and the Last.
Oh,
Stop,
Spellbinders and Arlington and the Improvs and.
There,
you know,
there were and still are a lot of those. Like Bart Reed, I think, still books the comic strip. I mean, there's still guys.
In El Paso.
He's still there.
I did that. Yeah. I did that. Yeah. I mean, I look at the map and I go, yep, been there. It wasn't until, this is fast forwarding through many more years, but at some point I made a decision to sort of segue over from, you know, after I moved back here and I parlayed stand-up comedy into producing, and I had my own show for 13 years, and there wasn't a lot of comics here. Right. I had to be resourceful.
Sure.
But I started doing corporate gigs. I got a speaking agent. So if you change your name from comic to humorous speaker, there's a substantial difference in the paycheck.
Exactly. Right. That's why everybody's doing TED Talks now and stories.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I did a TED Talk too, but that's kind of after the fact. But then that's kind of, I didn't work the East Coast, but I did. Yeah. I did have a gig in New York at New York Plattsburgh University and in Rhode Island, and had a lot of fun. Sure. A lot of fun gigs. Yeah.
What I like to think you did, and just because you know we've commented each other on Facebook over the years, just on pictures you put up and not pictures I put up, but. One thing I commented about to my wife, I was even talking, I go, you're kind of a, you're a great template of how every comic or every smart individual should approach a career, you know, when you're putting yourself out in front of people, because what I see a lot of older comics from our generation, you know, they always said, I'm not getting any bookings. You know, they expect all these people to have these clubs, and you know, that just all you got to do is make a call and then they're going to book you. You know, you self-produced. I told Slade Ham, he's another guy that I just had on a few weeks ago. He's done 60 countries, six continents. He's done 44 USO tours. I said, that's more than Bob Hope. He goes, maybe.
Wow.
But he's a real humble guy. And he finally said to myself, he just put out his like third or fourth special on YouTube because he said, you know, when I had stars in my eyes and when I was young, I said, I'm going to get the Tonight Show, I'm going to get HBO, I'm going to get a sitcom, kind of what we're all led to believe. But, you know, he said, finally, I said, if I can, I'm over here in these war-torn areas and I'm making some 18 or 19-year-old kid laugh when in reality he could be dead tomorrow. I mean, that's about as, you know, that's about as black and white as you can put it. But what I meant about you is you didn't just say, oh, I just hear so many comedians say, there's no work right now. There's no work. Well, then go open a damn club yourself, you know.
Well, that old saying, if opportunity doesn't knock, build a door.
Exactly. And you certainly did that. I can see that. Just, I mean, I knew you always worked up there and you know, and then you started your whole thing where you teach comedy. And you're someone who's actually who I would, you know, a lot of comics are teaching comedy, but they never left, you know. They never left their little coven of where they do comedy. I mean, I don't think you can really teach comedy if you never kind of left your little 10 square miles of your hometown and you've just been, okay, never went on the road, so now I'm going to teach comedy.
Yeah, well, the more you can bring to the table, you know, in the way of experience and demographics, the because no two students are alike. I mean, I've been teaching it for 27 years now, and I had a kid come up to me after one of the very first shows that I produced, and he just had this passion in his eyes. He goes, do you ever do any open mic nights or teach? And I'm like, yeah, no, I really don't do that. But I could not stop thinking about that guy. And to this day, he's doing comedy. He's a friend of mine. His name's JR. Cool. And he lives in Reno. And so I couldn't stop thinking about it. I mean, I'm a sucker for passion. If somebody, if I have something to offer somebody that I can share my experience and strength and hope with them, then I'm down. And so that started another, a whole nother level. So yeah, comedy in and of itself just was the was the birthplace. But then it went into, you know, producing the shows and then it went into teaching, and it went into writing a book, and it went into, you know, speaking. So it just, you have to kind of keep reinventing. And I when I had my son, you know, I was, you know, I was 38 when I had my son and 43 when I had my daughter. And hell, I was almost a senior citizen by the time I had my second. And I didn't, you know, first I thought, oh, I'll take them on the road. And I tried that a couple times, you know, but they can only play with the Bible in the drawer so many hours. And so I was like, you know, I want to do, I just always believe there's a way to do what I love, where I love. Like I know you really can't have every single thing. You got to give up a little something. And, you know, when I first moved here and had my son, and I'd see all my friends on TV, they'd all have their own shows or be guests, and I'd have a little pang, but then I would go look at my backyard with my rose garden and go look at my son sleeping, and I'd go, no, it's okay, you know?
That's good. I'm glad to hear that, because it really is the only path to sanity to me, I think. You know, it's like, how many people have I seen? I've seen more comedians have to pull up the GoFundMe page, and these are guys that are on TV, and these are guys that have had successful careers, but then they pass away and the GoFundMe page comes out. I always, you know, a lot of comics gave me a hard time for getting into teaching, but I taught the at-risk youths. You know, I was in the kids who were in, I was in all the kids that were from juvenile hall, and they were on house arrest, and they were wearing anklets, and I won't say who it was, but one of my former students just passed away. He was in the, you know, he had some celebrity on the, you know, in the Real Housewives of Orange County and that type of stuff, you know, and he had a tough life, you know, and I, he was another one of the kids, and all the kids that I taught guitar to, and that's something I just started doing. I brought in my own guitars, and then I did it, and the kids, I still see kids, there's a cowboy kid you love, his name's Cole Crosthwaite. How's that for a name? He he lives somewhere up in your neck of the woods. Big strapping kid, and he's got a big wears a big cowboy hat, and he plays guitar, and he'll chime in once in a while. He goes, Mr. Stein, yours is the only class I didn't skip when he come to my guitar class. He goes, that's the best class. And I've had a lot of kids go on to, and they'll drop me a line. That's when you know when you have a pretty good post, because you'll see a like or a comment from someone you haven't talked to in like 15 years. So I guess the algorithm isn't true. I don't have to hold my finger down and copy and paste. I do not allow Facebook to have authorization of any of my photographs. Oh, yeah, that'll work. That's all you got to do.
Never have done that one. But
And that's so another thing I want. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, you and I have that in common because I worked with at-risk kids, too. Mm-hmm. And I actually went to college, got a 4-year degree, and then I became a comic. My dad was just thrilled.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I got a degree in social services and corrections and worked with at-risk kids. Mm-hmm. And I always thought it would be fun to maybe you can do this where you are. Put a class together called Throw Punchlines, Not Punches. And take it into like an after-school program and have it grant funded or something. Because I also taught a kids class for a long time called Cocapelli Kids. But good for you for doing that work. Cause that saves lives. That changes lives. And people come watch you at a show and it's great and they're entertained. Mm. But what you did for those kids, you know, that pays big dividends. And
Think so. I didn't, cause I'm not a conformist. I mean, I always said the best alternative teachers were alternative themselves. I mean, I'm about as, I'm not too embarrassed to say I told those kids some what I perceive as real truths because I've been around the world a few times. You know, I've seen a lot. So I wasn't just mailing in the boilerplate curriculum all the time because these kids, I had a guy, John Fishley, that I worked with and he taught photography and he taught it. He got all these 35mm cameras. He'd fix them because he was an old, you know. They always say these kids are kinesthetic learners. They're hands-on. Yeah. They don't want to hear somebody babbling up at a chalkboard while they fall asleep in their seat. Just like adults. When the teachers used to go, I always used to say, the teachers that used to make sure their kids wouldn't say a damn word when they were sitting there pontificating on all their whatever the hell they were talking about. They were the most chatterboxes whenever there was an in-service. And that's why our kids were. The kids were like, I taught shop. I brought in like coping saws because I'm an old handyman. I used to build room additions and stuff. I'd bring in just a jigsaw, coping saw, some sandpaper, and we all built, you know, birdhouses, and we built, you know, little cute little benches and tchotchkes and all kinds of stuff. And I still got pictures of them doing that. And what are they? They're involved. They're alive.
Yeah.
Building something, you know.
Yeah. Well, everybody learns differently. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, you know, I school was horribly boring for me. I mean, I got through it, but I was writing movies in my head in elementary school.
Sure.
You know, I was writing movies. That's why I loved teaching that kids class. The first thing I did is I told them they don't have to sit in a chair. I said, you can sit on the floor on this mat, or you can sit in a chair, you choose. And so all the, you know, they were all the ADD kids, all the ADHD kids from school that had to sit in a chair all day and just giving them the freedom to have their body where they wanted to have it was huge, huge freedom. So
I used to have this one kid. He was a gangbanger and he's deceased now, sadly. I'm in well under double digits of kids that I had who lost their life through some different horror. But he was a smart kid and he loved Tupac Shakur and he would go to the sister club of the coach house. It used to be called the Galaxy.
Oh, that was in San Juan Capistrano.
Right.
I know exactly where that is.
And I played that like 5 or 6 times, and I played it with Billy Elmer. I played it with
Elmer. God, I haven't heard that name.
He's
for
back in Pittsburgh too. He's still.
Everybody goes home at some point, right? We all leave.
I know you got. It's kind of returning to the roots, but
back to the homeland. Yeah.
But he had a bunch of sister clubs. He had a coach house in like I think it was in Ventura. Then he had one down in San Diego. But the Galaxy one was actually a bigger venue because the coach house was kind of. Everything was flat, but the Galaxy had like stadium seating with, you know, brass poles around, and it was, they had a full green room where you could go in the back, and they had kitchen, and then they had cheese platters and stuff. But yeah, so my kid had done a couple of shots over there doing rap and stuff, you know, but it was a kind of a sad thing. I won't say how he died, but it happened in Las Vegas. But he always told me, he goes, Stein, this. school's indoctrination. I mean, I encourage him. I go, well, you ain't lying. He goes,
it's an institution. He goes,
school
sure.
is indoctrination. But the sad mm-hmm. thing, I used to say, we all of our schools were always in kind of a little areas that were kind of almost like strip malls. But when we were in San Juan Capistrano, I was there for like 13, 14 years, and it was heaven because it's basically a kind of a little tourist town. You know, you have the mission. One of my kid actually ended up getting the job as the bell ringer at the mission because he's a Huaneño. He's actually one of the Huaneño Indians who are the that's the heritage tribe of that area. You know, that's the indigenous Mexicano tribe, the Huaneño. So he got a job, and he was like, he had already had a baby. He was in high school. He had a girlfriend, and he was like kind of going. And, you know, he was driving like the biggest Ford, because I had a Ford Explorer at the time. I'm trying to think of what the biggest SUV, and he was driving that. And half my kids, like, they would take like a driver's ed class, and they didn't have their license. Then they'd get out in their car and drive. My kids that I had, yeah. And, so anyway, he ended up getting a job as the bell ringer at the mission, which is not a bad gig. You know, it makes you about
right.
as connected as you can be in San Juan. But Steve Odekirk, I don't know if you remember him, but he moved down there.
Oh, yeah.
And he came and talked to my class one time, you know.
Yeah.
Because he and I and Daly Pike, we did a show once at like a place called, I'm trying to think if I remember the name. I posted it once. It was in like Cypress or... It was a little club in Cypress. Now it's like a Cold Stone Creamery. But I always say, who's the comic from Texas? He used to do the Ross Perot impression. Jack Mayberry. He used to do a great.
Oh yeah, Jack.
He goes. Old guy will always tell you what everything used to be. See that from over there? Used to be nothing but dirt. All from here all the way over to here, dirt. He goes, and he ended up doing Ross Perot on Leno, which, you know,
he did a great Ross Perot
because he kind of looks like him anyway. Yeah, he looks like him anyway.
He does. He nailed it. I still remember Jack Mayberry's some of his first jokes that when I used to see him at the Comedy Store, he used to do those observational jokes about. You ever notice when you empty your macaroni and cheese into the pot, there's always one piece of macaroni stuck to the glue on the inside. I mean, remember that 36 years later, you know, I used to see him at the, the Igby's reunion picnics. Just a funny guy.
I went there. I was always proud that I made it into that club because when I would be on the road in my 9-month motorhome, this guy, you know who, you might know this guy, Al Canal. He's a legend in the Funny Bones. He used to book it.
Yeah, yes.
And now he books the Wilbur, some famous. Now he books a big theater, like in either Illinois, India, somewhere over there. And like, you know, that's the play. They bring in big names. He was like the nicest. He's got a saying, I know Al Canal. You know, it's like a bumper sticker and stuff. So he, when he saw that I had worked at Igby's, you know, he gave me some spots. So do you remember, I've got two favorite Billy Reback lines. Can you give me a favorite really Billy Reback?
I cannot. I mean, that was the first job I ever had. Okay. And I was backstage terrified. Well, I just know he was really nice to me and he was very hairy.
Oh,
and
God,
that was all I remember. And then he went on to be the executive producer of Tim's show. I also worked with Tim Allen. That was so fun, but that's another story. But no, so tell me a Billy Reback line.
Billy, there's two lines, and I'm going to think. The one is, Albert Einstein, for a brilliant guy, he came up with E equals MC squared. Brilliant guy, though. You think he would have figured out that bad haircut plus no conditioner equals the frizzies. You think he would have known. And that's because he worked a room that I did. I'm trying to think. That's probably the other one was something about how he did this on Evening at the Improv. He said, they now have, what's the game where Trivial Pursuit, I think. They now have Trivial Pursuit for old people. And the first question is, what am I eating for lunch? You know, what I'm eating right now. So I should end it with the Einstein joke. That's the one I think that I really always loved. So I booked Jim Carrey in a room I had in San Marcos, which was down in San Diego. they have a college down there. And so I was booking this room for quite a while, and I had all my guy, Ron Coleman, and I had all the regular comics that would work. Ron Coleman always says I gave him his first paid gig. He was my opener, and he's back working in Vegas now, like going out of style.
Yeah, good for him.
Ronnie Coleman. So this guy said, what if I give you a big budget? Could you bring down a big show? So I actually called Bruce Smirnoff. I don't know. He was friends with Reback. Did you ever come across him? Because he's a hilarious
guy. Oh, yeah. No, I know Bruce. I know he books the cruise ships. Somebody was just telling me to call him the other day if I want to go back to work on the cruise ship.
Oh, so but, you've done those, too.
Yeah, I did 3 years on the cruise ships. So.
Yeah, I hate. Yep. I'm not even a real big fan. I've done 10 cruise ships, and my wife and I are going on another one when my daughter goes to college in the spring. Next fall, but I'm not. You know, after doing 10, it's hard for me to get past the disembarkation, you know.
Oh, the muster station.
Muster, and I always wear earplugs.
The bing, boom, bing. Like those tones. I have PTSD.
I have bad ears. Like when I go to a movie theater, because there's going to run 27 minutes of previews of coming attraction, and it's all going to be bomb and shoot up movies, because that's what movies are. Bombs and shoot up.
Right. Glass.
I mean, I don't just wear those foam earplugs. I wear the kind that are like, you know, industry standard for like jackhammer, you know, guys and stuff.
What are the best earplugs you've ever, because I wear earplugs every night because I can't sleep. Because of my ex-husband's snort. And so what's the best earplug you have ever come across?
Well, I mean, I've got so many different ones. They're different degrees of density. Like usually the, you know, if you're messing around with your little CVS Rite Aid earplugs, those are going to get you.
No, just skip those. Go right to the power, which is the best one.
Well, I'm going to have to, because my wife just got me some that you put in your ear that actually... They come in a case. There's two of them in a case, and they're not even foam. They're a rubber thing, and they go in
little spirally things. They look like a corkscrew.
No, they're not. Yeah. In fact, those don't really do much ear. Those are almost more for us swimming. Those are for people.
Yeah.
And I even buy silicone earplugs from. There's a place called. Well, it's actually because I swim. We have a pool at the house here, and then I swim at the base over here at the Los Alamos Bay. For years I bought a, what is it called? I always thought TYR, TYR is like a Speedo. It's like a brand of suits and head caps, and they have their own earplug.
Yeah.
But my wife, you know, she just, you know how you can, that's why Amazon is a multi-billionaire, because you go, why should I drive to Long Beach to get the Tier or California aquatic supply in Huntington Beach when I could just order them, get them cheaper, and they're there the next day. So Tier has a silicone. I've noticed too that you can't, when I sleep, see, fortunately my left ear is my hearing ear and my right ear is their ear that helps hold up the glasses. So I usually plug my left ear because that's my better ear. It's like old Abraham Simpson. He goes, this is my seeing eye and this is my winking eye. So I usually do okay if I plug, because if you plug both ears, then you hear your heartbeat and you have a whole situation.
That's me.
Have a situation. I'm an expert on all this stuff. So if you close in a Volkswagen Bug, not that I've owned one in years, but I can still remember the smell of a Volkswagen Bug.
Me too.
Exactly. See,
me too, especially in the heat.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
But if you close an, of course, if you close a Volkswagen Bug and the windows are up there so airtight that's what you're doing.
They make a vacuum pop.
That's what you're doing if you plug both ears. So I plug, if you really want to have perfect sound, well, my wife got me, you know, the things that you might even be wearing now. We don't ever go, like, we have Apple phones and I have Apple computers. But she got me a perfectly good set of Apple-style wireless earplugs when I walk around the neighborhood, listen to the Angel game, or I listen to my Gilbert guy.
Yeah, AirPods. Podcast.
Yeah, but they're $30. They're not
$200.
I'll send you the
Okay.
One. And then, so if you... I would suggest you plug whatever your better ear is with one of those silicone swimming earplugs. They mold.
They're both good ears, and I got to plug them both because I'm just symmetrical like that.
Man, you're
lucky. No, they got to both go in. Jeez. No, they got to both go in.
But what I'm saying, yeah. do the wax on one of them, and then do a high density foam air plug in the other one. Then you won't have the Volkswagen bug slam door situation.
Oh, you got to be careful how you take them out too. I mean, we've gotten way off the comedy track here, but you have to pop the seal, because if you just pop them out, you can create a vacuum and you can actually damage. The reason I say this is because my ex-husband snored for 12 years, and I swore never ever would I ever go through a snoring situation again. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? Mm-mm. I was wrong. I got a boyfriend now after 12 years of being single, and wouldn't trade him for the world, but I got.
Well, then you gotta. My wife put me on the CPAP. You know what I hate about the?
That's what every, I think we
every
need the
TV
CPAP.
Show now. Every goddamn TV show now. They put the big guy. They gotta put. You know, they gotta the whole scene where he puts on the CPAP, which is another way of emasculating, and we won't get into that. You think you Me Too gals had a hard time. You notice how for the last 20 years, every guy has been a namby-pamby milk toast, where, you know, but that's another 10 minutes. I'll wear the CPAP if once in a while we can get a guy in a show who actually, you know, isn't wearing a dress.
Watch Louder Milk, because there's a girl on a CPAP. She's got a CPAP on there, not a guy. So So are you? Why do you wear one earplug at night? What, are you protecting yourself from your own snoring?
Oh no, I don't. I really don't have to wear earplugs when I sleep because I sleep. I told my wife the other night, you know, here's an article here where it says people are. The older you get, you know, because her parents are still alive, and they go to bed at like 8 o'clock and they wake up at like 4 a.m. But I'm 60.
That's me.
I'm 68, 69.
Me.
My wife says that hasn't occurred to you yet. I could go to bed, and unfortunately, I still stay up way too late. And even when I taught, I didn't have to be there till 9 because I was the get ready now. I'm gonna here's a humble brag. I was the site liaison.
Wow,
and I'll give you $100 if you can spell liaison, because I can't even remember how to spell it. It's got some real mixed up I's and A's on different
sides. Is it L-I-A-S-I-O-N?
No, I think is that too easy? That's close enough, yeah. It might be right. That's the one where, and I'm a great speller, but I don't know. I always had to check my business card. Okay, L-I-A-I.
Oh.
Might have another second I. But anyway, I was a site, so I'd roll in 9 or 9:30 in the... But I sleep, like when I saw John Cleese the other night, I was so pumped up. I didn't go to bed till 5 a.m. And sadly, my daughter, who's 18 now, she's copied all my bad habits. You know, she stays. I see the light under her door at 2 a.m. And she,
that used to be me.
Yeah.
That used to be me.
Yeah,
but then, well, I still had show business time and show business energy. Yeah. And then I had kids.
Oh,
and then I was a single mom. Geez. And then I had to get 2 kids to school and get up at 6. I would take my kids to school, come back and sleep from 7 to 9. And I would sleep like the dead, because I knew I didn't have to pack lunches or sign homework or get them to school. But
and is there any better sleep at our age than like the occasional afternoon snooze? I mean, I can.
That's almost
out.
Every day. I'm a napper.
Sure.
It's a highlight of my day.
I know.
I mean, it's sad. My boyfriend and I. Did you get a good sleep? What time did you go to bed? What time? Did you, every day.
Yeah.
And then there's usually a nap involved, and so a lot of my life revolves around. I even started wearing this watch. I got this Garmin watch and a Fitbit watch to see how much REM sleep I'm getting. Except for I had to put the Fitbit away because it had me getting a lot of steps in the middle of the night when I was sound asleep. I go, well, this thing's a piece of crap.
Yeah,
I'm not wearing this anymore. But yeah, sleep is a very important thing. But in the old days, stand up. I mean, it was go to bed 2, 3, 4, get up at 10, you know?
So you're pretty you still do speaking engagements here and there, but it's not like you're out hustling.
I am not on the road. I had some great work lined up when COVID came, like everybody else. So that came and went, and by the time that was done, trying to get everything back on the books, 6, 8 months out, a year out for some of these gigs, then it was time to get Social Security, and I was like, let me think about this.
Yeah.
Do I want, you know, but I just say I'm semi-retired. I mean, if the right job for the right amount of money for the right audience comes, it would be very hard for me to say no. I will. Right. I would never say I am absolutely never going to work again. Right. And I do get some offers, but I don't want to be somebody's auctioneer at a political fundraiser. Right. I don't necessarily want to do a private party in someone's living room. I mean, it's just like, you know what? I'm very lucky in that, you know, a lot of people don't get to say no. And I didn't get to say no for 30 plus years. So you just get a reflexive, yes, I'll do the job. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'll drive there. Yes, I'll go through a blizzard. And then at some point, my own sense of survival and self-esteem started to kind of win. Like, I just worked like all of us. We work so hard to get from open mic to open to middle to headline that it's really, it's in my blood.
Yeah.
It's really hard to, it's not like a job that you go punch a clock for 30 years and you're like, okay, I get my retirement. I'm done. Because as you know, it's a lifestyle. It's, it's so a part of who we are that it's, I've even thought about maybe starting like a support group for people trying to retire from comedy.
Exactly.
I just, it's hard. Like I was at the improv many years ago and there's this old
which
comic.
Which one? That, which improv? The down here?
Up at the lake at Tahoe.
Oh,
At Harvey's.
Is that the one that Howie, is that the one that Howie ran?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's and not, this, that's not there anymore though.
No more. Okay. No, that was my backyard club for a long time. Man. But This guy who'd been doing comedy for years in the Reno Tahoe area, just he couldn't get, and he was a big deal in the day, but we all have our day. And it's like, you know, is there a time to kind of slip out gracefully at the top of your game? But he came to the backstage door, just literally begging, begging to go on stage. And
just for the time.
No, he was beat up and broken and desperate. And I looked at Howie and I go, dude, that's going to be us one day. And I didn't ever want to be that. I didn't want to be like that, you know? So I'll still teach my class and I, you know, I might write another book. I wrote a book 6 years ago and my daughter
A cup of coffee with
cat? No, it's called Cat's Daily Cups.
Cat's Daily Cups.
And it's still
you should
on
write
Amazon.
Another book because you've got experience that few any comedians have ever done the way you forged your own path. I mean, it's really, I think it's to be commended how the way you took care of your whole career. You kind of did it your way, you know?
I did. And on my gravestone, if I had one, which I won't because I'm too cheap to buy one, but it would be that it would be that I got to be there for my kids and stay in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed in my house. I got divorced like 24 years ago or 23 years ago. And I'm still in this house. And I mean, there were lean times and tough times. But
did your husband stay close enough around that he helped with the kids? Did some
he moved just far enough away to not be helpful
because
not too far different zip code, but I mean he had the kids every other weekend and then that's when I that's why I never had any days off because full-time single mothering is a big job, and then on the weekends when I could have used some alone time, that's always when I would cram my work in. So no, he was a good dad, and
I'll say this for you. I've seen your kids. It's John and Emma, right? John and Emma. And you know, like I do, my wife always said, if I put a picture of my daughter up, it'll get more than if I do one of my greatest Gilbert Gottfried memorial trees. All you got to do is put one picture of the kid up, and like you've seen people, and that's a visual medium. But I'll say one thing that I can see. Like I even wrote this down. This is on your Facebook page. I'm a mother of two great kids, comedian, speaker, author, stand-up comedy workshop facilitator. But you led with I'm a mother of two great kids. And I'll say this. I was never like the biggest fan of the Kennedys and Camelot and all that kind of stuff. But I just inhale documentaries. I've watched all of Ken Burns, baseball. And I saw that you have something on your thing about bluegrass comedy. Maybe you just went to it in Missouri, but But I'm just such a fan of everything he's ever done, and mm-hmm. and rewatching and watching a JFK thing that was just made fairly recently, where they really, it was like a three-part. It was just beautifully done. And Jackie Kennedy, mm-hmm. who I always felt kind of, Jackie Kennedy with a pillbox hat and all that stuff. But she said, mm-hmm. I always prioritized, and it could be said maybe she was a little, you know, because she really, you know, kind of corralled those kids and made them do. But she said something I thought was very poignant. She said, I always felt that no matter what you achieve in life, and, you know, she was the first lady and everything else, you know, if your kids don't end up well, then nothing else matters. And I just, the way she put it was more poignant than that. But I thought, you know, good for her, you know, because she did, you know, she kind of didn't like the public being in the public eye in the final analysis, right. because she hid from it. But I thought that was kind of neat. And both of her kids, I think, did, you know, they did turn out well.
Well, it's, you know, it's the best, it's mm-hmm. the best gig I ever mm-hmm. had, the hardest mm-hmm. and the best. Mm-hmm. But I was real clear that mm-hmm. they had to come first. Mm-hmm. And, cool. and mm-hmm. some of my, you know, my initial pain of, I want to stay, mm-hmm. I want to keep building my business. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I want to da, 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 da. Mm-hmm. And then I would look at these two humans mm-hmm. that I had the privilege of bringing mm-hmm. to the planet. And I'm mm-hmm. like, no, you get the best of me.
Wow.
You get the mm-hmm. most of me and the best of me yeah. and the rest, mm-hmm. you know, and I hope I've done a good job with yeah. them. I couldn't be more humbled and honored mm-hmm. to be a mom. And right. I, you know, I had a, when I lived in LA and I was single and I was mm-hmm. doing all, I was living the life. Mm-hmm. I just was having, but I watched one of these baby shows on the mm-hmm. Learning Channel one day something shifted in me. And I was like, oh my God, I better yeah. start thinking about this. Like, I could do stand up yeah. until I can't speak anymore, but uh-huh. I can't get to be like 65 and go, I think I'll have a couple kids. So mm-hmm. I completely shifted mm-hmm. my kind of my manifesting powers, if you will. And I never, and my kids sometimes goes, Mom, we feel bad that you had us and you didn't get, you know, you didn't yeah. get to
the Tonight Show and all that.
But you know who's going to come around my Thanksgiving mm-hmm. table every year? Mm-hmm. My kids, mm-hmm. my family. Not right. people that I've met on the road, not mm-hmm. other comics, not yeah. people in the audience. They're going to give zero shits about me at the mm-hmm. end of the day.
Right.
But my family, mm-hmm. they're for keeps, you sure. know, they're forever. So.
And I hope you get I hope you get a grand one of these. I'm hoping to get a grand before I, because I didn't have my kid till I was 50.1 half years old. So I.
Wow, you beat me. Yeah.
And then,
yeah,
and then
I don't have.
Yeah.
Any yet? I don't have yeah. any yet.
I'm hoping.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Me too. My
That's the real prize. But when you start, you know, you started late for a gal, and I started late for a guy. But
yeah, we did. Yeah, yeah, a geriatric pregnancy. That's what they call me. Yeah. But, well, just get me a walker and get out of my way, because I got a kid to get out of here. Jesus.
Do you ever watch Dying Laughing? Did you happen to watch that by any chance?
I did. Ooh. I did watch some of that. I mean, yeah.
That's pretty. And I'll give it to them that they kind of, they certainly didn't pull any punches. You know, it's not a video you want to show at your teaching class. Here's what you got to look forward to. Because it wasn't all the schlubs, nobodies. It was all mostly big name, Gaffigan, Seinfeld. And they're telling it like it is, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's not all, you know, not all glamorous. And there's a lot of people we've lost to a lot of addiction. Yeah. A lot of addiction, a lot of disease, a lot of mm-hmm. sadness. And conversely, you know, some of the absolute best times of my life that you know how it is. Yeah. It's like it's a club that you'll never get out of. You might mm-hmm. change your rating in the club, mm-hmm. but it's like we're kind of all in it on some level forever.
And that's what I like about it. Like, a lot of people bash Facebook, and I've found it for myself. Hold on, my computer just went to sleep. I just got to keep looking at these bars. As long as I have audio waves, I know where. I see comics, because when I worked, there was a particular guy I worked with, he goes, and you know, our school was like, it originally had a name, Horizon, which It's like George Carlin used to say, remember when in the war it used to be called shell shock? It sounded exactly like what it was, shell shock. He goes, now it's, you know, operational exhaustion, something fatigue. They put a hyphen in it and they took all the human. Sounds like what happens to your car. I've got operational exhaust fatigue, whatever it was called. It was four words.
Right.
And this guy used to say, and then they turned it to, they called it access, which was perfect. That was when they changed it, like with George Carlin. It was an acronym. Everything in my school was acronyms. It meant Alternative Correctional Charter Educational School System, which is a bunch of horseshit, you know, because it was just the way to. And every time my principal would come in, she'd give me a new acronym. I said, what does that stand for? And she never knew. She didn't put it to memory. And so that when people say that Facebook is, I mean, I certainly enjoy it. I've connected with people from my hometown. I went and played golf with all my old cronies from high school in Myrtle Beach. I mean,
nice.
You know, and I connect. And so what I just now started a coffee clutch in Huntington Beach at the Whole Foods. And by the way, Jazz Kaner said to say hello.
Oh God. I worked with Jazz and David Gee on one of those first road gigs in Texas. And David Gee and I were up on the balcony throwing tennis balls down into the pool where Jazz was swimming. So you tell him hi for me. Cool. I don't know if that was Spellbinders. It was one of those clubs, but God, that was it. And David Gee used to keep a journal. I think he still does. But
he's funny.
So funny.
He's the best host, MC, although obviously he could headline him. But he's a guy, and for years, I think he's been doing that. And I think he used to come up and do that gig up there, the Howie Nave
up
gig
at the lake. Yeah, and I used to book him in my room several times. I mean, he's money.
He's the kind of guy that as a comedian, you want to watch him. That's how good he is, you know.
No, he's just a consummate pro. I toured with it was short-lived, but it was called Boomerang. Mm. What was it? Boomerang Baby Boomer Bash. And so it was Mark Yaffe and David Gee and I. I was like the Peggy Lipton and the Moz Squad with those two guys. Good. And we did a couple of runs together, and it just was so much fun.
Yeah, that's the way it should be.
And David was just a great writer, and his Nicholson I don't think he can beat that one.
And I just always loved his Vin Scully, because he did a great Vin Scully. And Vin Scully's like Chick Hearn or Mel Allen. I think he was large enough, because he used to do golf and other stuff. But just when he's in L.A. and he did, sadly, he just had a little bit of a problem. I don't know if you said he was like mugged somewhere in Texas. And,
what?
Oh yeah, he was mugged.
David Gee
was mugged, and people were trying to find him, but he survived it. You know, he ended up in the hospital.
What? Oh my God! I have to go check in on him.
In somewhere down in Texas, but people were.
Was he working on the road?
I think he was.
Oh God! I thought he'd kind of stopped doing that.
I saw him posting on Facebook the other day, and he was back to being as alert as ever. But people were kind of worried about it.
Oh, absolutely! No, he's a nice guy. But I met friends forever in this business, and I wouldn't change it. And I don't know, maybe I'll write a memoir one day about all the other cool stories we never got to today, but I just wouldn't trade it for anything. And when I went to LA, I just thought, you know what? My dad was like, there's going to be so much rejection. It's going to be horrible. Uh-huh. You're going to have so many no's. Well, the most negativity I got was from him, you know? But it was like, I just shut up. I just didn't. Mm-hmm. I was super clear at the end of the day.
You weren't an only child, were you?
No, I was the eldest of four. And I just was like, I have a little technique. I do a little psychological thing where I just fast forward my life. Like, what is it going to look like on those last days? And I just was sure that I didn't want to live with regret. I could live with rejection and no's and being broke, but I could not live with regret.
Right. Well, that's great.
That's not a fan of regret. Yeah.
That's what all the positivity, power, motivational people always say now, don't put it off. You know, my wife fortunately loves to travel, and she's, you know, I've gotten to go to Australia, New Zealand, and places where, and, you know, we're going back east this. In fact, I'm going to try to visit Bruce Smirnoff. We're going to, I think Florida's the one state that I've never really spent a whole lot of time there. I've been to, you know, on my motorhome trip, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people are saying that's the, because people are kind of fleeing California and kind of mm-hmm. by organically, we've both kind of avoided politics and religion on this talk, which is a good way to keep. I love what Don Rickles, who had a nice 50-year career, he had the whole thing kind of boiled down to four words. I don't do politics. I heard him say that a couple of times. And, you know, he did just fine without doing it.
Yeah, I don't do it in my act. And nope. I don't do it, you know, I could do it
because like everyone else, I have my beliefs. But, you know, I don't engage arguments and battles on my Facebook page. Every once in a while, I'll say something, and somehow it was misconstrued as being political, and then the person gets a nice, you know, they get a nice deletion on the page. That's the one thing good about Facebook. If somebody says something fast enough, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
So could you, as we're winding down here, could you tell me, because I like to hear if you've got any up-and-comers that you've kind of seen around that you like, and I also, of course, want to say some of the elder statesmen like that I would write about on my memorials. If you have any favorites of the, you know, of the people who were kind of an example when you were coming up, you know,
it's such a big question. It's such an apples and oranges question. Yeah. You know, it's like there were so many of them that.
Well, how about just from the female side?
Yeah. I haven't seen her for a long time, but I used to go see Elaine Boozler. I'm friends with her on Facebook now. I watched her and it with amazement. Yeah. And Paula Poundstone, loved watching her. Crowd work was amazing.
Wow. Yep.
people, maybe other people, you know, Janine,
Garofalo.
Yes, Garofalo. Yeah. I used to, because she was so smart and she made me. She made me think Larry Miller was one of the funniest guys. It's actually because of Larry Miller. We didn't get to that story, but he's a reason why I started comedy. I saw him up at the lake and I was I saw the Groundlings and Larry Miller and I was like, I want to do that. People who I like comedy that is not necessarily technically perfect. I like comedy that processes emotion and that comes out in words that makes me feel stuff.
Yeah.
So I like comedy that's a little sharp, edgy, messy. You know, I worked with Robert Schimmel. He was really dirty, but God, he was so funny. And I couldn't even believe that I was working with him. I got to open for Rob Schneider up here in Reno a few years ago.
Wow.
Really love watching Rocky Laporte, one of my favorite guys to watch over and over. So there's so many, but there's not a lot of comics that I would watch over and over again necessarily. Bob Newhart, not like a stand-up comic, but his cadence is just, but this Nate, Nate Bargatze, Bargates, Bargatze.
Something like that.
I love like listening him? To, I do. Yeah.
It's almost like therapy. It's almost like white noise, just hearing him talk because it's kind of,
it's
calming.
Yeah. He's soothing to me. He is totally soothing to me. There's so many. I don't even know what the name of that star is on Loudermilk, but whatever his name is, I love him.
I want to say that he's the guy that was in Office Space, Ron Livingston, maybe. He does that commercial where he comes in and he asks the chick for coffee. She goes, "What do you want?" She's doing that vocal fry voice. He goes, Why do you talk like that? What are you talking about? And then when she leaves, she goes, "You're an asshole." He goes, "That's it. You're using your voice." I think that's who it is. But I met a guy at one of my friends, this Bert Toplitzky, who I've been hanging out with. He's a longtime comedy. promoter and producer, and he's been a stand-up for many years. He's written books, and he put on a show at the Balboa, I guess it was the Balboa Bay Club, very ritzy, and a guy named Kevin Flynn, who's in Loudermilk, he's one of those guys who was lucky enough. He's a Boston guy, and he's been in like every one of the Farrelly Brothers movies, you know. So he's in Loudermilk, and he had a part in every, like, it's like, you remember Steve Sweeney and Lenny Clark?
Yes.
Remember?
Yes.
Steve Sweeney and Lenny Clark.
I love
hilarious.
I worked with Lenny Clark in Reno. Oh, yeah. I loved him.
Back in the day, we almost died
in a plane crash. Oh, yeah, geez. He and I. Oh, on the way to Las Vegas, the worst thunderstorm ever. Jeez. I mean, we were hanging on to each other for dear life. But yeah, he was very funny.
Hilarious.
Just so many funny people over the course of my life that I'm super inspired by and who have left me, enriched in a different person because of how hard I've left. What about Ari Shaffir, his last couple specials? Yeah. What do you think of those?
To be honest, like, I know he's got a lot of fans. I don't know, there's a certain angriness now about, and I like Joe Rogan in his podcast.
I
never was really the world's biggest. I mean, I just think he, you know, what he said about the time, what he said about Kobe Bryant, that, like, that's not something to me to really get over that fast.
Yeah.
I mean, he's, you know, I always say he's got a, like, I'm not really a big fan of, and I don't want to bring this in on your podcast where you're my guest, but I've never been a big fan of rah-rah arena comics, which is like what Bert Kreischer is, the guy who doesn't wear a shirt on stage. Like,
oh, I don't even know who that is.
He doesn't wear a shirt. That's what he's got famous for. And he laughs at everything he says. I used to always say, if I'm listening to a radio show and it's a Zoo morning radio show and everybody's laughing, then I'm not laughing because I'm listening to be entertained. If you're laughing, I'm glad you're having a good time, but you're getting paid to do a radio show. And there's a thing called, I hate to say it, there's a thing called pseudo-bulbar disease. It's where people are laughing and constantly, it's kind of an affliction, you know. I have students
like a Tourette's.
That have it. I mean, half of Bert Kreischer's set is him laughing, and it's this huge, wide ear-to-ear grin, and he's laughing, he's performing. I say, okay, well, I'm glad you're having a good time, but I don't hear no material. You know, everything's about how big.
No, that's annoying. Yeah.
So he's probably, I don't know, Ari Shaffir, I mean, I guess I watched a little bit of the one where he had the million candles all lit around, and that was kind of his forgive me tour after, you know, saying, I'm glad Kobe Bryant was killed in a helicopter with 18 other people. So, I don't know, I find him to be, I don't really like, there's a lot of anger in a lot of those comedians now, and I don't find it. I mean, look at Jonathan Winters and these guys. They were funny as hell, and they were nice, and they were kind of nice and genial type of guys. So,
affable. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wondered what you thought about him. My son, you know, actually told me to watch his Netflix special, which I did, and I thought it was
pretty good.
Pretty edgy, sure. Good. But,
yeah, well, maybe I'll give it a shot because I didn't, after watching that candle one for a while, he's been doing it long enough, and Joe Rogan was his biggest supporter because that's why he was the exemplar that Carlos Mencia had ripped off. He had specifically ripped off him, and, you know, he's been doing it long enough, he knows how to write a joke.
Half of these people, I don't even know who they are anymore because I drive into Reno and I see all the billboards of who's coming to which casino, and I hate to say it, but like, you know what? There's a million more people behind you in line. You know, we just get the light in the sky one day and that'll be that. And there'll be a million more people. And I just hope that there's a good enough quality of comedy that keeps being written and with real jokes.
I know. Yeah, my dad used to say, I used to go to the movie for a nickel. And my dad was funny to me. He's funny because he loved, the great thing about the Seinfeld show is that my dad loved it, I loved it, and my daughter, that's three generations that can laugh and will watch reruns of a show and they'll laugh at it. But my dad always says, he always called him, it was the ultimate insult to Jason Alexander. And that's not even his real name either, but that's his stage name. But he said, he goes, I saw Costanza. He's got another sitcom. He goes, he's not a lead guy. He's a second banana guy. That's what I loved about my dad, because he really, you know, he really crystallized everything. He goes, and then Kramer, he had a show too, but yeah, he's funny, but he's not a lead guy. You know, but Costanza, the fact, because just the name itself. But then, of course, he loved Julia Louis-Dreyfus because, I mean, for a pretty lady, she was about as funny, you know, as you could get, you know.
Absolutely. And
especially for that show. And
yeah.
And she's sticking it to all of them, to use her old term. You're sticking it to me, because she's had at least two shows that were successful after Seinfeld.
No, she's brilliant. Yeah. I love her and Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. You know, Kristen Wiig. There's so many wonderful female comedians that didn't necessarily come out of SNL. But, you know, as long as they just keep us laughing. Mm-hmm.
Tina Fey and Amy Poehler did the best, you know, hosts of all those dumb award shows.
They sure did.
Which I still don't think they should even have a host, because just have that announcer guy bring the people up, because everybody is a host when they're up there presenting their, you know, the award to the people, the recipient. So I don't know why that, I think that's a dinosaur to have a host, because it's just cringe. It's a cringe job, you know.
Right. So, all right. Sure can be. Well,
we've had Kat Simmons here, and I'll give the, I think it's, do you really want to plug anything? You're free to do it. Don't you have a katsimmons.com?
Oh, webpage? Yeah, there it is. It's super easy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
katsimmons.com.
If you can remember my name and .com, you can get there.
And she's available for large arena keynote speaking jobs. This must be a large arena, though. Did you really work with Zig Ziglar at least once?
I did. Damn. And that might be one of the claims to all my fame. I had to get the microphone out of Zig Ziglar's hand because he was getting his Lifetime Achievement Award, and I was the comedian. Ooh. And I went down on stage because before I went to LA, I was listening to all his motivational tapes and stuff, and I forgot all about that. But yeah, I held the microphone up to his hand to answer a question. He grabbed it out of his hand. I was like, my God, you never let go of your microphone. So his daughter is looking at me like, if you embarrass him, I'm going to kill you. So that was probably one of my singular notable things, is gracefully retrieving the microphone out of an aging Zig Ziglar's hands without insulting him. But yes, I did do that. I forgot all about that.
Well, that's a nice place to stop, because we've gone from A to Zig.
I know.
A to Z.
I know. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we'll be at the Edwin Lounge performing on the drum.
On Cahuenga.
Hey, it's very good to talk to you. I got to go fertilize my trees. That's my big job this afternoon. Yeah,
maybe. Usually, I poach when I post this, and that might have been my first pee I popped. And I have a screen. I usually poach a couple pictures off your Facebook page when I post that on Facebook, and this will probably be coming up. You're about a week and a half back in the rotation. I've got a Steve Mazan. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he's...
I filled in for him once when he couldn't make it to a gig in Arrowhead in a blizzard. I did the job for him.
Well,
is that funny?
He's the nicest guy in the world, too. And
He really, I don't think I ever worked with him, but I filled in for a job for him once that he couldn't make. So that,
he's a little younger than us, but he's got quite a story, too. So maybe... listen to his, but he's got quite a story too about how he got.
I will
David
now Ray. That now that now that mine's in the can, I'll listen. Ah, but I just hate listening. In you know, there's actually no
smart.
Can. I know that's just radio. That's just radio lingo.
It's radio talk. All right, Kat, it was a pleasure talking to you.
You
really
too.
Was.
Nice to get. If you had to start a podcast to get caught up after 35 years, it was nice to talk to you.
Okay. Well, hopefully, we'll talk to you again inside of 30 years.
Okay, I hope so. Bye. Thank you for calling.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks, Kat. Bye-bye.
Bye.